I have one request, Rick and I do actually, that when you are speaking of things of the heart, speak in the first, in the present tense, if you would. Speak of it from yourself. I. Give I statements. Does everybody know what I mean by that?
You mean the first person?
First person. Yeah, not necessarily. Yeah, I'm sorry. Not first person, not present tense. First person. Not third person or they or those out there, but when such and such happens, I feel so and so, or I am so and so, or I felt so and so. That will keep it out of the head more, and we want to stay with the stuff of the heart. Blaise Pascal, one of my favorite quotes from Blaise Pascal, is, the heart has reasons that the mind knows not of. Do you love by reason? You might want to think about that. Reflect on that one. Ponder that. Yes. I want to start with another story. Jesus was on his way to Jairus' house with his disciples. And this is a story within a story. I'm rather excited about Bible stories these days because I think the essence of human potential movement and psychology and death psychology and the wondrousness of life is all there. It's just that we have these accretions of culture and horrible Sunday school teachers that that have kept us trapped in a kindergarten view of these things. And hopefully you'll hear them anew. But the story within a story is unique because they were on the... And it's really almost like a, what is it in English literature? And it's a sort of aside or sort of this little part, and then they go on to the main point of the thing. But actually, I think this is the main point. But they're on their way to Jairus' house, whose daughter is ill. And Jairus was a leader of the synagogue. And again, like last night, Simon was an influential person. So is Jairus. And I think the disciples were excited because here was an opportunity to make some points. You know, if go and heal Jairus' daughter, we might get on the good side of those in power. But Jesus was always attentive to the present moment, as many of us are not, and myself especially. I'm sorry, I've got things I've got to do. I can't talk to you right now. But this story is unique because it's told in great detail. And it starts out saying that there was a woman with a hemorrhage. And she had had it for 12 years. A bleed, if you will. And most scholars feel that it was probably some kind of uterine vaginal bleed. And it says she had been to many physicians over those 12 years, spent all her money, not gotten any better, but only worse. I'm sure all of you know people like that, or have been in that category. I do. I know a lot of folks who we see at the center who have spent all their money and for years have gone hither and thither to find help and have only gotten worse. Well, this is very clear in the gospel. And she spent all her money, 12 years, on physicians, not better, but only worse. And she heard of Jesus of Nazareth coming. I'm sure there was great excitement around that. Imagine the aura of surrounding Jesus. I mean, all through the scriptures, you read a fifth of the gospel message is on healing. And you read all through that, and he healed all who came to him. And at dawn, they came from all around, and he healed all of them of their infirmities, and on and on and on. It must have been this enormous sense of expectation. And as he was traveling through this village or whatever on his way to Jairus' place, she thought within herself, as it says, she reasoned, and it must have been told many times over campfires and all of that later. Perhaps she became a follower on the way. But that she, if only I can touch the hem of his garment. And that wasn't so unusual in those days. In fact, the whole idea of the shadow falling on somebody of a healer or touching a garment, and that happened quite regularly. But Jesus was getting a reputation for being a renowned healer. She said, I'll be healed. I'll get what I want if I can just touch the hem of his garment. She knew what she wanted. She had this bleed. You can imagine her feelings of what that was like to be a woman in that society, bleeding, made her unclean by Levitican law. What would that feel like to be isolated and being withdrawn from the community for all that time, or at least a great portion of that, off and on? So there's an enormous amount of fear and anger and bitterness and all those sorts of things going on, I'm sure, in her mind.
Shame.
Shame, yeah. She moves out into the crowd, and that took guts too, because anybody she came in touch with, it's like that woman last night, isn't it? She moved out into the crowd to touch Jesus. And he was what? Jesus was Rabboni, rabbi. Rabboni is a higher grade of rabbi, I mean, of great respect. We don't like to think of Jesus as Jewish. Jesus was a Jewish rabbi. And may in fact have been wearing the tillit, the parashol with the fringe and all of that. Because in Jairus' house, we know what he did later, and that's an interesting theological thing we could talk about. But she comes out or sneaks into the crowd, and there must have been people milling around. Imagine, lots of people, and they're on their way, and they're walking. It must be dusty, warm, and expectation. And it says, she grasped the hem of his garment, and immediately the power went out from him. Before that, it says, though, the hemorrhage stopped, okay? And she knew within herself that she was cured. The hemorrhage stopped immediately. And Jesus felt the power go out from him. Now, isn't that interesting? You know, 20 years ago, we would have said, well, just hyperbole or metaphor or whatever. I think there's a lot of evidence now to indicate what that really was. Maybe some of you have even had that sense at times of energy. We can talk more about that. And the hemorrhage stopped, and the power went out from him. He stopped. He knew something had happened. And he says, who? Everybody must have frozen. And the disciples were really snide here. I mean, it's really a very, it's humorous. They said, what do you mean, who touched you? Can't you see the whole crowd is touching you? They're all pressing in other words, just to, you know how that is around famous personages? It's like the Pope or a baseball hero or whatever. Everybody's pressing in to press the flesh and touch the clothes and all of that is to this day. And he said, no, who touched me? And we know what that, he knew somebody had nipped a bit of him, stolen, short-circuited, or not short-circuited, but taken a bit of what he was about. And he looks around, and it says, she came forward, but before that, can you imagine? Probably, whoa. You know, are they going to stone me? What, am I going to be rebuked? What's going to happen here? And she fell before him. She said, and it says, she told him the whole truth of her life. The whole truth of her life. How do you, can't tell someone the whole truth of your life in 5 minutes. My feeling is, and we don't know this, but that Jesus took her aside. He often did this with people. I mean, we see it many times. You know, he took the blind man out of town. He took the person that was deaf and dumb out, away from the crowd. And I'm sure it was the same thing here, that he took her aside and probably spent many hours with her, much to the dismay of the people and certainly the disciples, because they were on their way where? To Jairus' house with a sick child. And we know later that he got there too late. The women were wailing, said, "You're too late, she's died." So there must have been a hiatus here of time. And the words that come forth are the same words, actually, that were spoken last night. And I'm sure these words were spoken over and over and over again, the stooped woman in the temple. But there are examples of it. This is the only time, though, that the only time that Jesus calls her, or he calls her daughter. And that's a shortened form of daughter of Abraham. And so he restores her. He puts her in the context, if you will, of this community. She was considered unclean, outcast, all of that, but restores to her herself in the community by calling her daughter of Abraham. Daughter, your faith has saved you or made you well or healed you. Go in peace. And again, the literal translation of that is walk in God's shalom. Walk in the shalom of Yahweh. The peace, the well-being, and that can only happen in the context of community and relationship. Did this woman get what she'd come for when she first touched the hem of his garment? Yeah, I suppose she did. Sure. Sure, that's what she wanted, didn't she? She wanted a cure for this affliction, yeah, this disease. But Jesus knew that there was something more, didn't he? I mean, he must have. He could have let it go at that. Could have said, "Well, bless you, my daughter, you got what you came for, now I'm on my way. I've got more important things to do here at Jairus' house." But did not do that, because the words come and she told him the whole truth of her life. He must have invited her into that process. So that what could happen? What needed to happen for her?
Well, she had her wellness within her, but as far as her relationship with the rest of the community there, it would be the case that nobody else would know this. She was, at that time, the only one that knew she was well.
But was she well? Why would Jesus invite her? The question is, why would Jesus invite her into a process of telling the whole truth of her life? What does that mean, to tell the whole truth of your life?
Wouldn't he know her whole life?
Would he?
Without her telling him. I mean, he's the Son of God. All she does is walk up there, and he knows her.
He maybe knows her intuitively, but does he know all the details? As true man? Put it in creedal form.
I think that was for her own understanding and enlightenment.
For what?
He doesn't need to know all the details, just like the woman at the well, he knew what she had done.
She had a physical ailment, but the physical ailment would have caused her suffering that goes beyond the physical ailment, and there would be all of that to cure.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, but telling our own stories, we also heal that spiritual and... other side of ourselves. And I think it's very powerful when we tell our own stories, because in sharing our own stories, the other part of us is healed as well.
What happens when you speak forth your story?
It says in the scripture, she told why she had touched him and how she had been instantly healed. And to me, that was to tell others what Christ had done for her. He had healed her.
Okay, that's part of it.
She had to make the first movement, and then he healed her. She had to touch him, reach out for him.
But then what in the telling happens? What in the recounting? And she probably didn't do it in front of all these people.
It says she did.
The truth sets you free.
You release yourself.
Part of it. But do you think she spent hours telling it in front of everybody?
No. You wouldn't have to. Why would you have to spend hours?
Well, the Greek is that she told the truth of her life. I couldn't tell the truth of my life to somebody in 2 minutes if you told me. If you asked, I'd have to spend hours, and I'd have to really have a relationship of trust to do that. I could no more tell all this crap and stuff I've been involved in in 2 minutes in front of you. No. I don't trust this group yet to do that. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And does she trust that community? Who's
no.
No. Well, I mean, she could still get it. Jesus hasn't restored her to the community in those words, I mean, in that sense. Even then, there must have been a lot of fear.
I think it strikes me that healing, the physical healing, happens at different stages of people's process of wholeness and forgiveness. Like Diane was saying last night with the Mary coming into the dinner party and weeping and wiping with her hair and tears. That was the end of her process in a way. I mean, that was a culmination of something that actually didn't involve physical healing, but in this case, that was just the beginning of a process that needed to continue and unfold. And Jesus refers in other places to people who experience the physical healing but don't experience the faith or the wholeness, you know, who sort of walk away after the physical part. So it's like this was the start of something for her rather than the culmination of it like last night.
Yeah, the start. See, the point of it is, in my work and in the work that we do at St. Luke Medical Center and St. Luke Health Ministries, is that people come often for the magical cure. just fix it, doc. When in reality, there's an enormous amount of baggage and pain. And the immediate cure may, in fact, you may be stricken with much more. A public health statistic is that 10% of the population has 90% of the disease. Think about that. What might have happened to her had she not received the fullness of all of the process that Jesus probably brought her through? She might have started bleeding again. Something else might have happened. See, what it connects to is all that we are in emotion and spirit and mind is also how it's reflected in the body. Gene Achterberg, who's a famous researcher, PhD in psychoneuroimmunology, has stated that all the sins of omission and commission that pass through us in our life do not pass without leaving their corporeal mark. Do not pass without leaving their corporeal mark. Our bodies remember what our minds often do not. They hold it. Maybe she had tried to induce an abortion 12 years prior. We don't know that. What about that? The guilt, the pain, the whatever else was going around in within her. And the cure, the magic pill, that which without the depth of knowing, which is a process.
I think with her having these hours of talking, it's like journal writing and sharing. It's a purging of yourself and understanding. This is what she had to go through to understand who she was, so that she could be whole. And I do the same kinds of things when you write, and it's amazing. You go back and read it. Whoa! I didn't know I was thinking that. I didn't know I was feeling that. Becoming aware of who you are and where you're at, maybe where you're going.
That's the vitalness of journal writing, mm-hmm. and reflecting with another, a trusted friend, spiritual direction, counseling. That is a leading in the process, because we can so often spin webs of deceit around ourselves and ego protections and all kinds of things, and it's very important to be able to speak it clearly to someone.
Another thing about that process of releasing is that it opens another channel for the healing process to come in, where before it's been blocked. And I think that's a neat circle kind of situation.
The question I want you to hold, actually for this whole time, is what does it mean for me to be healed and whole? What do I need? Maybe some of you have recently gone through a divorce, or single by choice or circumstance. Maybe there's stuff from childhood that continues to reverberate. Maybe there's a physical handicap which you were born with. Whatever it is. Whatever is holding you from being all that the gift of life is supposed to be for you, for me, what do you need? What would you ask of Jesus? Put it really where it is. What would you ask of Jesus if you were the woman with the hemorrhage, or the woman at Simon's dinner, or blind Bartimaeus, or the man at Bethsaida who had 38 years worth of excuses of not getting into the pool to be healed? Oh, what a bunch of hogwash. Jesus said, "You want to be healed?" Right? He's asking. Well, of course, but I just can't get in. You know, the angel comes and stirs the pool and I just can't make it. And I have nobody there to get me in there. Bull. Didn't want to. Had all the secondary gain of the illness.
Is that fear of success?
Oh, yes. Well, we'll come to that. You bet. And what does it mean to be changed and transformed and healed? Well, you know what you got, but not what you might get. And it might mean martyrdom, or it might mean doing something else. It might mean a whole lot of things that are pretty scary. Huh?
Taking responsibility.
Yeah. See, because most of us, live on this axis here, and this is called a bent axis model. I talk about it in my first book. And this is called neutral living, this axis. Most of us live most of our lives in neutral, in monotone. Frederick Franck, who is a famous artist and physician, poet, writer, wrote that we live our lives in monotone, in neutral, going on binges of violence as individuals or in herds. Going on binges of violence as individuals or in herds. Think about that. How do we go on a binge of violence individually? Overeating? Shooting our spouse? I mean, there are many ways we go on binges of violence. Or herd violence. I mean, the worst of that is nuclear weapons.
Or even living in a reactionary way instead of pro-action.
Yes.
One simply is tossed around by the waves, that I am tossed around by the waves of whatever or whoever. And I live in continual fear and reaction from what might happen.
This is a very reactionary place to be.
Out of control.
Out of control. Yeah, victim.
Yeah.
This is real victim state. When you're neutral, when you fail to ask that question, what is it that contributes to my healing and my health? What do I need? But you live by rote, failing to ask the deeper questions. See, that's why life has to be lived in the question. Continually. It's only in the question that something new can happen. Otherwise, it's all victimization and reaction. And rote living. And it's usually because our stuff is fixed at an early age. We get the same junk that our grandparents had and our great-grandparents and our foremothers and forefathers, and it gets passed on. Spiritual abuse, family abuse, on and on and on. And so we live in unawareness in neutral, and things begin to happen to us, signs and symptoms. Those of you that are health practitioners know what that stuff is. Stuff you can measure in another or in yourself objectively. Or subjectively hearing about it. I mean, what are the signs and symptoms of this woman? Let's take the woman with the hemorrhage. Bleeding. Yeah. What else? What if you were a friend of this woman? What kinds of things might you think that she would, what would be signs and symptoms of her illness?
Her outcast state.
Huh? Her outcast state, sure.
Her outcast state.
Yeah, what else?
Depression.
Depression, yeah, probably. Maybe she was anemic.
Weakness.
An association with everybody.
Yeah.
Not wanting to be around.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, she maybe wasn't living so, well, she maybe was living in unawareness too, but not so, but she was trying to get around this corner, we'll come to that, to a different place. But she had a dis-ease, if you will, ill at ease, which was part, the disease was uterine fibroids or an attempted abortion, chronic infection, who knows what it was. But the illness is the greater part of that. That includes all the relationships and all the communication or lack thereof or relationships or the lack of integration in the community. The illness is everything, the suffering, all the parts of the dis-ease. That had that gone on, what might have happened to her?
Suicide.
Suicide, yeah, it could be. Yeah. Sure.
She's already isolated from the community.
She's isolated. Yeah, I use the word disintegration.
She was
already
emotionally dying.
Emotionally dying.
Could be not necessarily physically, but it could be in any other way.
Yeah, dying in sense of communication within the community and relationship. In many ways she was dying, and dying prematurely. Maybe she was quite young, who knows?
She probably had a high sense of guilt.
You bet. Death, it ultimately leads to death, and premature, I put on here. We all die, let's face it, but most people in our society die prematurely. Because of choices of lifestyle, because of living in neutral and unawareness, and we spiral down in this axis like this. So finally something gets us. You know, it's that heart attack and drop dead or whatever. The 10 greatest killers and causes of morbidity in this country are all problems of lifestyle. Corporate and or individual choices. I would probably venture to say that that's probably the case all through history and time. It's just changing. And it's more dire because of the state of our earth and environmental issues and all of that. What drives this? Rick brought it up.
Fear. My fear of being vulnerable and telling my story is part of it.
You bet. And this is the predominant model. You see, it's the model that that woman was in for 12 years. That story is so contemporary. It's just absolutely contemporary. She was trapped in a model of disease in which she tried to seek an intervention, maybe was never dealing with the root causes. And she spent all her money looking for that. We know it all the time, don't we, in our society? Look at the 37 million American working poor who have no health insurance, who end up going broke, if anything at all, illness, disease-wise, comes along. Or look at the statistics of 12% of the GNP being spent on healthcare or disease care. Actually, it's this. It's curative care. 97% of that is in disease care. Fewer and fewer people at higher and higher costs with less and less results. And that's an absolute fact. Trapped. False evidence appears real. Nice acronym. We think we're safe here, all right? In a sense. It's kind of nice sitting right up here, in unawareness, just hoping against hope that we're not victimized in some way, or that if we are, the magic pill fairy will come in and take care of us. But let's get off the bad news. That woman lived here. We all live here at times, this axis. But the call is to move around the corner to the growth axis, to awareness, understanding. How does this happen?
I need to be vulnerable. I need to be vulnerable in some way.
What's the call to conversion? What is it really? Take it out of biblical language. Pardon?
Telling
the truth. Sure. The capital T, right? Colleen said that to me yesterday. That's right. Understanding it becomes the yeast or the catalyst, if you will, for growth. And it's not to go into a kind of a new Gnosticism or that you can gain God by right knowledge, which is really a New Age promise. And that's, I mean, the New Age philosophical base. We're not talking about that. And although that's okay, and that's important. It's important. Education and reflection and speaking the truth and learning what the facts are. I mean, people still tell me I just don't believe that the environmental crisis is as bad as some people are saying it is. Well, they got their head up in the sand. The facts are facts about certain things.
You're talking predominantly of self-awareness here, though, aren't you?
Yeah, we can use this model in many ways, corporately and or self. Yeah, sure, and I'm mixing those two, and maybe that's confusing. Individually, very much so, a self-awareness and understanding. What is the truth of your life? What do I need to be healed and whole? What are all the things that impact on my health and healing or will make a difference for me? And then to speak it carefully and find out what they are in terms of being facilitated with other people and all of that, so that what can happen? Change, transformation. And that's the hard one right there. There's the sticking point for me. All the depth psychologists say that is for 95% of us. We're afraid to change.
Ken, I'm wondering also if this access can't refer to, in terms of theological language, things like the lower axis, the one pointing to premature death, albeit even spiritual death, that that is the old man or old person. The new axis is the new man, the new person.
The new person.
The spiritual versus flesh. Flesh versus it, spirit. Is that another way to say that? Or
well,
one could look at that.
I don't like that language too much because it starts you can get into dualism, mm-hmm. again, into Greek dualism, which separates mind, body, and spirit. And in biblical language of sarx, of that which is the ego, the not true self. This isn't the true self.
But just for the purpose of not trying to separate the two, but only to look at for the purpose of comparing and contrasting.
Yeah, I think that's right. Sure.
So I mean, I live in that lower axis a lot of the time.
Most of it.
Some of the time, maybe a little bit. I live in the other. You know.
Well, let's finish it out and then put a grid in here and look at it a little bit. Say where do we want to be? I mean, what after change then? Opposite of disintegration, integration. Moving towards wholeness. Life. Choose life then that you and your descendants might live. You know, Moses said in Deuteronomy, I set before you this day blessing and curse, life and death. Therefore choose life then that you and your descendants might live. This is curse and death. To stay here is. To live one's whole life there is. And the hundreds, if not thousands, of people I've seen over the years, so many of us sit in here most of the time. Towards health, healing. What drives this? Love. Yeah.
Faith.
Faith, yeah, hope. Love being the grandest of them. Greatest of these. Yeah, love of God for us first. God's very hand to us. In spiritual or Kabbalist, this is a tetragrammaton. This is Yahweh in Hebrew, YHVH, which is Yod Ha He Vav He, and that is the unpronounceable name of God that we put vowels in and call Yahweh. Well, in mystical Jewish spirituality and theology, this is the outstretched hand of God. This is really neat. Sense with holding the coin of compassion, and if we put it into Jewish or into Christian, connecting to our Jewish brothers and sisters and our roots are really not Hellenistic, folks, but we practice Christianity as if they are. Jewish thought is holistic. Hellenistic thought got us all screwed up. We are an Eastern religion. People get freaked by saying, you know, well, don't turn to the religions of the East. We are a religion of the East. But anyway, Yod He, the coin of compassion. And the coin is Jesus. Love, compassion. Out of the womb of God, the outstretched hand of God. Vav is our outstretched hand. Receiving, okay, the love and the compassion. That's what this is about. And it happens over and over again. It's not a one-time event. Conversion is not, have you been saved, brother or sister? You know, that turns me off when people say that. Because I know what they mean, in some sense. And I say, yeah, over and over. because that's the way it is. We are converted over and over. We are saved. We are healed. The root word of saved is salvos, means to be healed, and that's the root word for salvation, which is the whole sense of the Christian gospel. Go through it sometime and just put every word that has saved or salvation or any of that in there and just put healed or wholeness, and it fits every time, 100%. And it has other meanings as well, but that is a core understanding for what we're talking about. Jesus saved her, this woman with the hemorrhage. But how did he save her? He didn't say to her some nice moral teaching. I mean, he didn't say, well, you know, if you have all your little precepts right, and you worship in the temple, and you give your tithe, and da 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 da. No. Wasn't the point. Jesus saved her by helping her to reclaim herself in the terms of the relationship with the divine, as a divine lover. Yes.
He actually did three things, as you told it. One, the actual physical healing, and two, listening to her story, and the third one, letting all the people know that she was once again, or had always been, a daughter of Abraham. Yeah. She had that acceptance.
Self, the community, yeah, and to God. Restored her three ways. And that's what salvation is all about. That is what it is about. That is the essence of it. It's not to move. So often that the franchise religion that we live is one of love Jesus, get rich quickly, crawl through this miserable existence, and when you die, go to be with the Lord. Is that pretty close?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I'm sorry if it's offensive to anybody, but it's the truth to me. For me, I'll say it's for me. And I choose to stay in the church. But I think we need to speak it truly. That's the point, is to speak it out and to say that's what it is, but that isn't what it's meant to be. It's not what Jesus... That's not the power of the gospel. If the gospel is not transforming in our lives today, then why bother? It's a joke. It's a joke. And it's not the kind of God I want anything to do with. Paul writes, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Most of you are probably Lutherans. Sit here. Maybe not all. Oh, good. There's a few Lutherans. That's good. But those who... You know, for me, having grown up in Lutheran church and with pastors and grandfather and uncles and going back to bishops in Norway, that really smacked of works righteousness. You know, it's like work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Like you got to work your way in.
It says our righteousness is such as filthy rags.
Pardon?
It says our righteousness is like filthy rags.
Yeah, you can't, well... That's right. It's great. God's grace that allows us. See, that the point of that whole thing is that God's grace allows us to be on this axis so that we can place ourselves before God so that God can work in and through us.
It strikes me, God uses the broken things, and the bread and wine is the broken.
Yeah.
And we get the renewal, the life, constant renewal.
Let me give you some, with the risk of being dualistic, I don't want to do that. It's always and both, but fear, the act, looking at these growth versus neutral living axes, fear versus love, not versus, maybe that's not, there's always fear here too, but fear, love, I'll do it that way. Individualism, sexism, and patriarchy. Community, inclusiveness. Okay, I'm just going to give you something, you can think about it. contract, covenant. Disease, illness, health, healing. Loneliness, aloneness. Security, freedom. Martin Luther said security may be the ultimate idol. Think about that. Security may be the ultimate idol. Addictions, grace. Dualism, holism. Jacob's ladder, Sarah's circle. Control and status quo, surrender and change. Chronos, Kairos. God's in fullness of time, appointed time, chronological time. Death and destruction, new creation and resurrection. Disintegration, integration, alienation, reconciliation, stagnation, growth, competition, compassion. Religiosity, spirituality. Okay? Any more?
What did you mean by dualism? I don't have that concept in my mind.
Either or versus and both. We are always and both of all those. Total dualism is that mind is in Cartesian sense, Descartes, René Descartes, is that mind and spirit are separate from body, and the two cannot, there's no natural intercourse between them. That's blatant nonsense. I mean, that's biblical heresy. But we live it as if it were the truth. That's as far from Jewish thought and Judeo-Christian thought as it just isn't right. Anybody have any more that might fit this? Add to the list.
Ken?
Yeah.
I guess for me, I think the point that you just made is the most important. I mean, and I guess setting up, you know, I don't know, it's not a, where I get stuck if I'm in like disintegration or signs and symptoms and I'm there, then a lot of times if I want to go toward, if it looks like a pathway and I want to go towards wholeness, then I would say, I don't want to embrace those. It's like I want to go towards the understanding and transformation. And so I deny that those are going on.
Deny these?
Yeah, and what I found is that the most important thing is to, it's almost like they're side by side because it, and not like a ladder, but
there's a tension between them.
Yes, and you have to have it.
Yes. Yeah, I hear you, and that's why.
And it's continual.
Right.
Always.
Exactly, and in fact, that leads into what I want to say about this. You know, models are imperfect, okay, for one thing. Of course, mine is very close to you. But you want, what you want to do is take this and hold it in the fourth dimension. There's a wonderful book, The Boy. Oh, my son read it, and I'm just about to start it. The Boy Who, it's about the fourth dimension. The fourth dimension is not time. It's, I can't explain it right now. But anyway, shouldn't have brought it up.
At least tell us who the author and the
ISBN. I can't even remember the author.
How about the ISBN number, Ken? Give us something going on.
My wife would know that. She's a librarian. But that you want to form a grid here, okay? Let's look at this. This is a cube, and actually it's more than a cube, it's the fourth dimension, which I can't explain to you because I don't know it well enough myself. But that we're not here or here. We're somewhere in the tension of the two. And it's like when we die, which we all do, we die in the fullness of God's time. Like Moses, you know, it says in Deuteronomy, Moses died by the kiss of the mouth of God at the ripe old age of 120 with full sexual potency. What a way to go. You know, that's the truth. I mean, that's what the Hebrew says. They use a euphemism. It's like the fullness of his manhood or something. I don't know. But the actual Hebrew is that. And Moses died in God's appointed time in full stature of his person. Stephen died at a young age, the first martyr of the church, in God's appointed time, but in the fullness of time. Prematurely in years, perhaps, but prematurely in the fourth dimension or the this grid? Maybe not. Or a child of six of leukemia. I don't know. Well, that's painful stuff. You start thinking about that. So that when we die as integrated and transformed and whole as possible, but we die, and it's out here.
this is helpful, and it's pretty dualistic, or that's the way it strikes me. I think Diane was getting at it, so that these axes are kind of side by side in some ways, that maybe because I'm a up and down kind of person, but sometimes I go from somewhere low down on that, the neutral right. living axis, right. I'll find myself in integration,
sure.
you know, for a few moments, and then
yeah.
and then back.
Well, it's actually, that's the grid, see? That's the three-dimensional grid. Yeah, you get a cube and look at it that way. I just ask you to take that and take a cube and look at it that way, and this actually a clear plastic one would be the best way to do that. That would be kind of neat.
A fish in an aquarium.
Fish in an aquarium, yeah. That's good.
That's good.
Yeah, the sense I have is that God embraces all of that.
It's not meant to be dualistic, so.
It's, okay. I mean, every aspect.
Oh,
from,
we're all.
From our disintegration to
you
our
bet.
Whatever.
I mean, if we live beyond this space-time-energy-mass continuum, which is the cube. We live in other dimensions as well that are encompassed by a parabola, if you will, the very presence of God in filling all of this. This is all redeemable. It just helps to try and understand where we're trapped all the time. And you can't, you know, what we're trying to do is get us all to thinking about relationship in terms, you can't skip these events. I mean, you can't skip to, oh, I want a nice relationship or a marriage or whatever without moving through all this stuff. I mean, it just doesn't work. It's not the way we're put together. Nor can you maintain a marriage. Or whatever, or a friendship, or... I mean, my wife and I have been married 20 years, 20 and a half years, and by the grace of God, only. Willing to explore this stuff as individuals or together, and that doesn't, and that can be with friends, that can be in community, but it has to be done.
Into awareness.
See, she was trapped over here. In disease, signs and symptoms and disease. She got an intervention. She got a physical intervention, which often happens. We seek physical interventions.
But the physical intervention was not just physical.
It was.
Because the
first part of it was.
The meaning of the intervention had all kinds of things, or her spirit never would have.
Yes. Sure.
I mean.
But she. We go. Oh, touch, go ahead.
Touching had such symbolic meaning for her that you can't talk about it. It's just physical.
Well, I'm not so sure. If we want to look at it just in a way, if you want to just look at it from the point of view that she had been to many healers, and it was common to touch their cloaks or their whatever, and this was one more on her list because she was desperate. See, that's all I'm trying to say. She was desperate. She didn't know what would happen. She knew what she wanted. She wanted to get the bleed stopped. That's all we know. Now, maybe I'm presuming too much in the story. I think later is what I feel is what the whole thing really comes down to, when she told the whole truth of her life at Jesus' invitation, probably.
I don't think it would have happened if she didn't believe it was going to happen. If there were...
Yeah, exactly.
There's a holistic interpretation of the event
sure.
In your own terms. It's not just physical.
Nothing is just
physical ever.
All right, I hear you. And I don't need to make it fit in some way that I'm trying to manipulate. I agree with that. But in any event, she got a physical cure. And more happened because Jesus stopped and invited her into the process. That's all I'm trying to say. Does that sound okay?
Yeah, that's absolutely
right. And also, after 12 years, she reached a point where she was ready and willing to surrender.
I don't think, that's right, ready and willing to surrender, and I don't think she would truly be healed without explicating the whole truth of her life. I just know from my work as a physician with people for years, and I see people getting sick again and again until they begin to dig out the root stuff. And telling her story, so that she got beyond this. That's why, that's to get back to your question, how does it relate? I felt it related in the sense that she was trapped here, just like we're trapped here so often, or many people, 10% of the population have 90% of the disease, those folks anyway. To try to move out into this growth axis where Jesus took her, so that this could all be changed and transformed, integrated into the warp and weave of her life, put it in weaving terms, so that she might know wholeness again. That's how it relates for me. Does that help? Or still doesn't help? Can somebody else help me to help?
Some diseases put you in that line of thinking physically, mentally, and you have a disease that you can't help that puts you in this line of those feelings.
What if you have a disease you can't help?
Uh-huh.
Is that what you're saying?
Uh-huh.
I think a lot of the diseases we can't help, quote unquote, are things that in fact we need more understanding and awareness of, either individually or corporately.
Uh-huh. Like diabetes.
Yeah, diabetes
is... The results of that list there can be like depression, all those things can be the results of that disease at times.
Well, diabetes is a problem of lifestyle as well.
Right.
It is very much so.
But it can also be a disease that is incurable, and their lifestyle, they're trying to go out of line with it.
Well, let me give you a little clue about that. Okay. 70% of the American population is chromium deficient. Chromium is a major trace mineral in the function of the pancreas. Mm-hmm. Diabetes is a disease of immunology. It is an interning of the body on itself. And we know that now. And it has a lot to do with stress. I figured you might. And the point of it is that we don't know all the parts of it, but we're beginning to understand a lot more parts of it. So there's a corporate problem of food being grown by agrobusiness, leaching out the trace minerals in our foods and growing them with chemicals, one. So that we're not getting chromium, which is vital to pancreatic function and glucose functioning in our body. Two, a lifestyle that races around in our society, I mean, we all race around, unless you live at Holden. Maybe you race around here, I don't know.
Yeah, we don't ever race.
That's what they're doing here, relaxing.
Just reading about this for us. Give us stress here.
Yeah, see, the point I'm trying to get at, as we begin to understand and explicate some of the corporate and individual factors in that, we understand that diabetes is not just, we're kind of wild victims picked on by a capricious God. Some people think that. Oh, God gave me that to give me this to, so I'd be a stronger person. That's gaggy theology. Thank you.
Ken?
Yeah.
You know, it came to me when you're saying that is that sometimes we think of where we're at on the axis, and we only think of ourselves as an individual, especially in our Western culture. We don't realize that we're part of a world community, a cosmological community. And when you talked about the trace mineral problem, you know, that made sense, and that because of fear, you know, we as a community are part of such things as competition, materialistic thinking that looks beyond or fails to look beyond the necessity of I need to get as much as I can from you.
Yeah.
And we're all affected by that. So I think when we look at that, if we look beyond just myself to the society of which we're part of and the world of which we're part of, maybe we can see how fear is so much part. I mean, the effect of fear has an effect on everything of our life, and it's even especially the foods we eat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's a real problem because it's not just we as individuals are part of a broader community that is living out this fear response.
Yeah. Thanks. That's why I keep going back and forth between that which is corporate and that which is individual. It's all intertwined. I mean, the choices we make, we need to ask ourselves as a community. The Holden community is asking the question, how can we better live out our food? That's what part of Sherry Kelbaum's work as a nutritionist here is to review that and look at that and say, those are the kinds of questions we should be doing nationally, internationally. You know, I look at the way we make policies as this country. It makes me sick. We are not, we live here. I mean, cataclysmic events are bringing this about much. I mean, all that stuff in Eastern Europe and in South Africa, it's all so exciting and wonderful. And yet, our institutions are in crisis in this country. I mean, healthcare is a mess. I say that as a public health scientist and a physician. The public health infrastructure over the last 10 years has been systematically destroyed in this country. And it's absolutely immoral. Because health is a right of our being human. When you consider all that has impact on us as human beings, our spiritual, our emotional, our psychological, our political, economic health, all of it impacts on us and contributes to our diabetes or our heart disease or whatever. I mean, it's no wonder people who don't have access to proper foods because they're at the mercy of high-tech business that wants longer shelf life, that puts all this crap in our foods, who then are working poor, who do not have health insurance, so they don't have access, so there's no good health resource allocation and access to health care and health promotion and wellness, but maybe to disease care. I mean, you could go on and on. You can connect it corporately to the individual all through it, and that's all we're trying to raise here. This specter of this, and how do we fit in that? How do we fit in this cube as individuals and as community, church communities and social communities? It's tough. Oh my, it's hard. I struggle with it all the time. We try to live the, how do you live the gospel out?
To
to its fullest for you, for me.
It gets heavy sometimes.
Mm-hmm. You bet. And that's maybe the easiest thing one could say about it, heavy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's painful.
You know, one of the fears for me, as far, one of my blocks is the more I become aware, the more responsible I have to be. I have no more choice. I mean, I can't make blind decisions. I have to make responsible decisions. And so that's where it starts getting heavy. There's lots of... the more aware I become, the more conscientious I become, and man...
It gets heavier and heavier. Yeah. And that's why I really believe that community is vital. I am so much an individualist myself. I mean, I prefer to ski alone, hike alone, pray alone. I'm a Myers-Briggs INFJ, you know, so it's kind of like... And yet I know how enriched I am and how powerful it is to be with my sisters and brothers, whether it's St. Luke Health Ministries or whatever that the sense of my community is, and how much I need those people to be whole, to stretch me to be whole, or to try and even make sure if I'm feeling way down here that somebody else is up there. Isn't that the point? I think so. You know, when I'm sitting here, or here, I sure as heck want people up here.
Help you.
Yeah. Yes?
I was going to say, when you begin using your model, it seems like crisis is the root of all growth. And that what I've been doing in my life is beginning to welcome crisis, because I know that through the learning that that crisis will bring me towards wholeness. And I've been looking at it in the corporate world of really welcoming crises going on with restructurings and downsizing, and seeing all the crisis in these personal lives. And I'm saying, this is great, because without crisis, people aren't going to change. And the more crisis we have, the more we can embrace that, the more we can grow and experience that transformation towards wholeness. And so if we can begin to see crisis in a positive light and embrace it rather than something that's negative and to try to avoid or minimize, I think it's our attitudes towards crisis that's really important.
I think that's absolutely... Mm-hmm. Crisis means to make a decision. Mm-hmm. So...
Me also fear that we are not, I'm not called, I don't think, to run away from fear or to deny fear or to deny death, but that is only when we can truly live in our fear, with Christ with us in that process, we'll find healing. Whether that fear immobilizes us and we get in danger, or we become cycling downward, or whether it motivates us to action and we can trust the process, that darkness that we experience, that there will be light, and there will probably be more darkness after that and more light after that. Yeah. In that process. Yeah.
I have a poem that I'd like to share with you, and I don't know the author. It was given to me, and I don't know by whom. I think it was written by the person who gave it to me. I don't know. And you might think of this in your own terms. You might think of the woman with the hemorrhage. What might have happened had she not done, had not been invited into the journey, let's put it that way, responded to the call to wholeness? And then I'd like to end with a quote from Rainer Maria Rilke, one of our favorites, Rick and mine, and others at St. Luke's. This is called The Mask. Some of you might want to just get comfortable and shut your eyes and think of that woman, or put yourself, I don't know, whatever. Always a mask, held in the slim hand whitely. Always she had a mask before her face, smiling and sprightly. The mask. Truly the wrist, holding it lightly, fitted the task. Sometimes, however, was there a shiver, fingertip quiver, ever so slightly, holding the mask. For years and years and years, I wondered, but dared not ask. And then I blundered. I looked behind the mask, to find nothing. She had no face. She had become merely a hand holding a mask with grace.